Today on Rocking the Suburbs, we talk about wasted years.
Look, Stephen, I've told you all that beer drinking was purely for research purposes.
Okay, well, welcome back to Rocking the Suburbs. Jim and Patrick are still away, taking a well-earned break. So it's Mike Coley and I here, and we're continuing from where we finished yesterday, talking about Iron Maiden. So hi again, Mike. It's good to be back doing this.
Hello, Stephen. Good to see you.
Yeah, so we're just going to fire straight in from where we finished off yesterday. We're going to talk about the next three studio albums and talk about the first live album by Iron Maiden. And we'll go into talking about Peace of Mind, which came out in 1983, just a year after the breakthrough album of Number of the Beast. And I think you said yesterday, didn't you, Mike, that this was the first one that you got in real time, and I think it holds a special place in your heart.
Yeah, as I mentioned yesterday, I was introduced to them by a friend's painter's hat, and I really got into them. And then with my good fortune, I think what their best album came out as I was getting into the band. And so this one has stuck with me since I was 12 years old, maybe.
Uh-huh. It's, I'm interested that you think it's their best. I don't agree on that. I think it's very good.
Yeah, we've discussed this before.
Yeah, I think it's certainly it's not a ridiculous suggestion to say it's their best. Certainly, for me, the following album, and one we'll talk about later in the week, are the two that I probably put ahead of it. But you can certainly make the case, and I'm certainly not going to say you're daft for thinking it's the best one. Not at all.
I think it's just a part of that whole thing where what you get into when you're 13, 14 years old, 12, is what the thing that you immediately gravitate towards.
It hit you at just the right time. Everything was all the stars were aligned for when it.
Yep.
Well, again, continuing the theme, more personnel changes. Nico McBrain arrives as the drummer on this album. And so, we're on to the band's fourth album, and we still don't have the same musicians playing on this album as played on the one preceding it. And Mr. McBrain announces his arrival with somewhat of a drumming tour de force on the opening track. Which to many of you listening may think is an example of the use of the double bass pedal, when in fact it's not. He does it all with one pedal, because he famously considers double bass kick drum pedals to be undrummerly and insists on doing it with one foot. So, quite staggering, really. So the album we're talking about is Peace of Mind. And it has a number of great tracks on it, and it again continues the sort of the evolution of the band. And I don't know about you, Mike, but I think the standout cut on this track is also again one of their most well-known songs. And I think it's the song that we talked about yesterday, about how "Hallowed Be Thy Name" is kind of what the dictionary definition of heavy metal is. But I think "The Trooper" is possibly the dictionary definition of what Iron Maiden is. If you want someone to say so, and this is what Iron Maiden sounds like, play them "The Trooper" and you'll get every single thing that's in there. It's kind of, it's a perfect slice of Maiden.
I think even the most passive Iron Maiden fan, if there's even a possibility of being a passive Iron Maiden fan, anybody who knows who Iron Maiden is, I think "The Trooper" is probably the one song that
Right up there with "Run to the Hills," isn't it? As their sort of real classic. Yeah. Well, let's take a quick listen now, and then we'll talk some more.
Yeah. You fire musket, but I'll run you through. So when you're waiting for the next attack, you better stand, there's no turning back. The fewer sounds, the charge begins. But on this battlefield, no one wins. The smell of musket smoke and horses' breath is a virgin into certain death.
Oh man, that's good stuff.
Iconic.
That's just
the story behind that song. So it's based on the Charges of the Light Brigade. The galloping sound of Nico's drums becomes a signature sound of Iron Maiden from here on out, from 1983 until the present day. You hear his, that's his signature sound, that galloping sound he does on his drum kit.
Well, I would. It's like, I mean, I'm not arguing with that. It's their signature sound. Certainly, I agree with that. I think that some of that is still there on the earlier stuff, because I think the gallop, I think, comes from Steve Harris, and then Nico, being a better drummer, a more skilled drummer, he is able to tie in better with Steve Harris's style of playing, I think, because that gallop is certainly there on some of the earlier stuff. But yeah, the level of precision of what he does with the drums. I mean, when we just heard there, when he does that run down the toms, but he puts the gallop into, it's not a straight run down the toms, it's not, you know, he puts the gallop into the tom run, you know, which is, that's the finesse that we're getting now, that's the polish, that's just like, okay, they're really locked in tight. The musicianship is just another notch higher. And then you put it together with still the lyrics that's based on historical events and, you know, all these sort of things, and you still got the twin lead guitar attack, and it's just, yeah, and it's just another stone cold classic. I mean,
I'll come back to this over and over again as we get through this week, but just the subject matter of all these songs, some of it I was aware of at the time, some of it I had no idea what the heck they were talking about, but it had me digging deeper into things to further educate myself on these things, because I didn't know about the Charge of the Light Brigade when I was 13, 14 years old. And, you know, I read articles in different metal magazines where it would be referred to, the Charge of the Light Brigade would be referred to when talking about the Trooper. So here's me, little nerd boy, going down to the library and looking into it, see where this came from.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, I mean, clearly, it's because it, for those not familiar with what the Charge of the Light Brigade was, it was a doomed attempt by British cavalry in the Crimean War, where and it's a much bigger cultural awareness of that in the UK. Clearly, for that reason, poetry famously written about it, into the Valley of Death Day March and all this sort of stuff, and the highest military honour which you can be given as a British soldier is the Victoria Cross, and it's not a shiny medal at all. It's a black, dull black cross. But the metal that they use to cast the Victoria Cross, most people who get it aren't alive when they get it. Yeah, it's that kind of. I think it's like your Purple Heart or whatever the highest American equivalent is. It's like there's no greater reward for valor. But they used one of the cannons which was captured from Balaclava in the Crimean War to cast so if you have a Victoria Cross, it's cast from one of these Russian cannons, and they say the Charge of the Light Brigade was this famous paintings of it, and say poetry, and obviously this song as well about this, yeah, the cavalry just head barreling headlong into this artillery onslaught and just, yeah, complete carnage, you know.
Intense.
Yes, indeed. So the music does a good job of paying homage to its subject matter, because it has that intensity to it, and the gallop is never more appropriate in this case. Yeah, the musical and the thematic themes just tie together so well, and just great stuff again there. And I think you talked about with the, you know, we've said about the subject matter. I think both Steve Harris, who certainly still at this time was the primary, from the start of outset, had been the primary songwriter in the band, And you know, still is the, you know, the main man of Iron Maiden. But both him and Bruce Dickinson have a great interest in sort of historical history and mythology and all these things. And it comes out so often, as you said, Mike, the amount of times you'll see a subject, what's this about? You know, and so many of the later albums as well, they talk about these different historical events that you can then dig into. And they're both kind of, you know, certainly Dickinson is very much a sort of Renaissance man with his very varied interests.
That's exactly what he is—a Renaissance
man. Yeah, he's quite the one-off. But yeah, again, this it's one of those. It's one of the all-time classics. You know, if most other metal bands, if they wrote one song that good, they'd be pretty happy. For Iron Maiden, it's just, you know, it's like, well, it's in their top 10 probably, but where do you place it? You know, that's how many.
It's a coin flip at that point.
Yes, exactly. But it's up there in the very best of their work. And okay, anything else you'd like to say about Peace of Mind, Mike, or should we move on to Power Slave?
I just wanted to touch briefly on Revelations. Mm-hmm. That song is probably I don't know why, I can't describe why. I think it's just the way Dickinson delivers the vocals to that song. But Revelations is probably, I would say, top two of my Iron Maiden, favorite Iron Maiden songs. Uh-huh. And just the way he sings it, and he wrote the lyrics to this one, and it's got the religious pretense to it. And I grew up in a Catholic family, and my uncle is a Catholic priest, and so that whole element of Christianity has always like just been embedded in my brain since I was born. And so it's not particularly a religious song, but it does come from a hymn. It's based from a hymn, based on a hymn. And so, and just the way Bruce delivers the vocals on this song is incredible. And I got to see him do a spoken word performance recently where he just kind of goes through like his memoir that he recently released not too long ago. And he just spoke for 3 hours on his life. And at the very end, he asked the crowd if they had any requests. And somebody shouted out Revelations. And he did an a cappella version of Revelations. I don't know how old he is now. He's
65.
Okay.
Sorry, 63. 63.
All right. Yeah. I mean, but his voice, he really hasn't lost it. He did an a cappella, you know, he did like a couple verses of Revelations at that spoken word. And his voice is still there. He's still got it. And doing that in front of, you know, a sold-out audience in a small theater without any instrumental accompaniment, that even drew me in even more to this as being one of my favorite Iron Maiden songs.
I'll tell you what, as it's one of your favorites, why don't we take a quick listen to a bit of that, and then we'll move on to Power Slave. Okay, there you go, Mike. It's interesting, actually, isn't it? When that power chords kick in, it's almost, you could be going back to a Kiss song for a little bit, couldn't you? That three chord power, but of course everything else around it, he's like, no, this is not a Kiss song.
Yeah, especially when it kicks in after where you cut it off. It just kicks in.
Just go and takes flight as they often do, and it's if it was a Kiss song, those three, that power chord bit, that would be basically the song. Pretty much. Whereas that's just a little snippet. But you talked about seeing Bruce his spoken word thing. I guess as you said, that was in support of his autobiography. Which, if anyone's got a slightest interest in music, you don't even have to be interested in heavy metal at all, because he's such an interesting guy and has lived such an interesting life. I would highly recommend to anyone to check out What Does This Button Do?, which is Bruce Dickinson's autobiography. Absolutely fantastic read. Strangely, it doesn't go quite as in-depth on some of the Maiden stuff as you might expect, does it, Mike? Some of the sort of things.
No, it doesn't.
Particularly the reunion, which we'll get to on Thursday. It doesn't... Sorry, spoilers, everybody there. Sorry about that, but... It doesn't go quite as deep on the things that you might want as a fan, but as a biography of a really interesting person, just a great read from that point of view, because you're like, what as well, what, and this now? it's basically
what else is he gonna do?
That's pretty much it, isn't it? You end up looking at yourself and thinking, I've not really done much in my life, have I, really?
Yeah, it makes you feel a little less important.
But, so it's a highly entertaining and very interesting read. So, okay, well, let's move on. So they're still churning out an album a year at this point. So we're on to their fifth album, Power Slave, which comes out in 1984. And amazingly, this is the first album that features all the same personnel as the album which preceded it. And for my money, I think that shows, and I rate this kind of like either 1A or 1B as their either best or second best album. I just think it's consistent throughout. It's got the singles, the sing along singles. It's got the epic sort of opera, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which again is one for the literature and history hounds to get their teeth into and go, hang on, what's all this about? And it's got another iconic cover with Eddie as as the Sphinx and all this stuff. It's I'd probably rate it as their best or their second best album. I kind of always flip-flop between the two. But what about you, Mike? What's your thoughts on Power Slave?
Yeah, as you said, this is probably, as I mentioned, the Peace of Mind album is my favorite, probably because that's where I was on board with them immediately. Like, it just happened. Mm-hmm. But this album, Power Slave, is probably 1B for me. It came out right around my birthday in 1984, so I would have been 15 in 84, and I purchased this album with some of my birthday money, and this album, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, helped me get through ninth grade English because we were studying the book, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Well, there you go, perfect.
And they quote
lots of it,
quite a lot from the actual book. And my English teacher, apologies to Mrs. Armstrong's family, but she was pretty old. I'm this small, little tiny lady, what you would picture as a stereotypical English teacher back in the day. And she thought I was just some dumb music kid in the back of the room, and I was quoting, even before we started going over the book in class, I was quoting the book, and she couldn't believe it. So yeah, this album is seminal in my life because it helped me get through ninth grade English class.
I feel a little bit bad for your English teacher there, because she's probably gone home thinking, oh, I've really ignited a passion for literature in old young Master Coley there. And really, it was Steve Harris and Bruce Dickinson that had done it.
It wasn't you, Mrs. Armstrong. I'm sorry.
But hey, you know, if it gets, if it, it can get education as well. It's all good stuff. Yeah, I think it's just a really strong, solid album. There's no real weak tracks in it, and certainly the opening salvo. I mean, you had the first two songs on there. Not, you know, you got Aces High into 2 minutes to Midnight. I mean, there's not many better 1-2 punches to open an album with than those two again. Two Stone Cold classics again.
Yeah, and Aces High. The opening to Aces High is just a classic intro.
Yes,
the Churchill speech.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's the whole thing just put together is just again playing with historic imagery, and yeah. I mean, both of those are total classic tracks, and I probably 2 minutes probably edges it just for me. I think it's just the riffage, yeah, it's just slightly different kind of vibe to it. But both of them are just again real classic songs, and yeah, again as is a common theme with Iron Maiden, another iconic album cover, which is like yeah, they really use the imagery so well with Eddie, and then also. Falls into their sort of stage sets and stage designs that they then use. But let's take a quick listen to 2 minutes to Midnight, and then we'll talk some more. Saying it, Mike, but it's another classic. it's hard to.
Yeah, we've been using that word a lot this week.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the title of the song. I mean that comes up all the time with that. What is it? The World Clock, where yes. You know they have this group of people that determines the events happening around the world and how much closer. To doomsday we're becoming the doomsday clock yes. It is I think
yeah,
right
yeah, yeah
and so that's what the title of that song is referring to, and that's in recent years that title has come through the news cycle
yeah, I mean as
quite often lately
yeah I mean yeah I mean right now as we're recording here the war is raging in Ukraine and it couldn't be more appropriate. It's like yeah
exactly.
We really could be 2 minutes to midnight. It's yeah, sadly, a lot of the themes that are touched on in that song and many others on similar subjects are not are still sadly relevant, and I think still will be for a long while. But yeah, it's just that intro when the guitars kick in, it's just so good, and then the drums come in, it's just oh. And yet again,
the guitars right away just grab
yeah,
you.
Just, yeah,
it's, you're coming with us.
Yeah, there's no. Yeah, it's like, hey, you want some high powered riffage? Here's high powered riffage. Let's go.
There you go.
And then, oh, do you want a sing along chorus? Yeah, you can have that as well. Yeah, this is the funny thing about yeah for this yeah this one of the sort of the defining bands of heavy metal. their songs are so many of their songs have got sing along choruses that you just can't help. You know, you see them do a greatest hit set, you come out hoarse because it's not like you're just sitting there nodding your head for a lot of it. You're belting out all these absolute bangers.
they're catchy without being corny.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Yeah, they, I think that's part of the probably maybe the appeal why they still can sound fresh after all this time, and they can still stand the test of time. Because they don't write songs. Yeah, they're not writing "Baby, I Love You" or "Baby, I Miss You." Yeah, that's not, you're not getting that with Iron Maiden. yeah, you're getting.
Yeah, you're not going to hear that at the prom.
Yes, you're getting that. You're getting songs about the end of the world or about, you know, ancient historical events or about, you know, things depicted in the Bible or, you know, take your pick of whatever sort of deep artistic or cultural references you want to pull from. You know, whilst the music might be headbanging, the lyrics and music often, you know, subject matter are quite often not. So yeah, and again, just another absolutely stellar album. I mean, we're going to run a three here now from Number of the Beast, Peace of Mind, Power Slave. Three absolute stone cold classic albums. Can't go wrong. Take your pick, any one of them. You're not going to regret it.
and you touched on it a little bit, introducing Aces High or 2 Minutes to Midnight, but the album covers. Derek Riggs, I think, is as much a part of, you know, the artist mm-hmm. who did so many Iron Maiden album covers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one thing that we did, me and my buddies, when we were young. We'd get these albums, and we would sit there listening to it and then just studying the album covers.
So much detail.
Because he would put all these little Easter eggs. Yeah. There's so much detail and all these little Easter mm-hmm. eggs. And there's even more once you get to the next album that we're going to talk
yes.
about. There's so many Easter eggs in
there's
one.
A lot of detail.
It's just amazing to just sit there. I still find things in there that I didn't see years ago when it first came out. It's incredible, the artwork that Derek Riggs has done for this band, and it's as much a part of the band as their music, I believe.
Yes, and that spills over into the live shows as well, doesn't it? With the with the set design and all the sort of theatrics. You know, for those who've not seen Iron Maiden live, and we will talk about one of those live albums today. You know, the theatrics on stage. You know, there's always stuff going on. You've got aeroplanes. You've got giant, you know, 12-foot high Eddies fighting Bruce Dickinson with a sword. You've got, there's so much going on, and that flies both to the album covers, to say to the set design, and yeah, it's the whole package. You know, it's not just like, and again, this is probably going back to what we talked about yesterday with Steve Harrison, you know, rejecting the punk label. You know, there's not that. This stage design and album artwork is again also not very punky at all. They take a lot more from Yes. You know, I know Steve Harris is very influenced by those early 70s prog bands like Yes and Genesis, Wishbone Ash, particularly with the twin guitar attack, and that bleeds over into their love of great album artwork. You know, you're not getting Back in Black or the Black Album here.
Definitely not.
Well, you mentioned it, Mike, so let's move on to 1986 and Somewhere in Time. And this is the first time we've got a two-year gap between albums, and we'll come back to why shortly after we've talked about this one. And this is probably known amongst fans as the Adrian Smith album. It's the one where he did an awful lot more of the songwriting into this, and it also introduces the keyboards into the sound as well in quite a significant way, and again, it's a fantastic album packed with great songs. And when I was doing the same thing as you, Mike, we're re-listening to all the albums, you know, running up to this. I wish we could get a slightly different audio sound on this. If this one didn't have the 80s. Sheen on it quite so much. If this could be a little bit rawer mixed, this would be right up there.
Yeah,
it would be right
exactly.
there with the rest of them. The production.
That's why it's not, you know, 1C for me.
Yeah.
Basically because of that.
Yeah, if it sounded like Peace of Mind, then it probably would be. But it's a little bit like Purple Rain, like Born in the USA. It suffers from that. It's time of Genesis. You know, it sounds dated. in that way because of just the sonic qualities of it rather than the subject matter or the songwriting or anything like that. However, it does feature one of my top five favourite Maiden songs, which is Wasted Years. So let's take a quick spin of that and then we'll talk some more. Wasted Years, Mike.
That brings back some memories.
Oh, again, another absolute banger. I just wish the guitars didn't sound so mushy and chorused up.
yeah.
But this song perfectly illustrates, both in the introduction and in the guitar solo as well, why I really enjoy listening to the fretwork of Adrian Smith, because he just... Yeah, Dave Murray is an amazing guitar player, and he's got this very fluid legato, smooth, you know, a lot of hammer-ons, pull-offs, kind of very fast and fluid, almost sort of, I think Steve Harris described it as florid, possibly, at times, style. But Adrian Smith, he comes at it from a different angle. There's a bit more angularness to it. There's a bit more kind of... He sometimes will play the thing you're not expecting, and... Just with that intro there, with that sort of pull off riffage, it's just really, it's a great dynamic intro to the song, which basically what then becomes pretty much again a pop song more or less. It's not particularly heavy. It's very sort of tuneful and quite, yeah. You know, probably again because of the production, it's not going to scare the horses, you know. But it's a great.
It's quite identifying though as well. Yes. You know, I mean, that's one of those songs where. As soon as you hear the first couple notes, you know exactly what song you're listening to.
Yeah, you don't need to. Yeah, it's straight away. It's just a great intro and again a real good song. And just looking at the album track listing here, this is a thing that's becoming more and more the case as we move through their career, and we'll get even more so later. Yeah, this is an 8-track album, and the shortest song is 4:59. and we're regularly getting over the seven. We've been over the 7-minute mark plenty of times already with Phantom of the Opera and Hallowed Be Thy Name, but we're breaking that barrier 3 times on this album, and it's a sign of things to come later in their career as they get more and more. The prog influences sort of seem to come out more, but as you mentioned, Mike, it's another great album cover, just littered with little details for the fans to dig into and find and enjoy.
Yeah, I love that album cover. And then the video, the accompanying video for Wasted Years, there used to be a heavy metal show. It was a spinoff of the Headbangers Ball on MTV back in the mid to late 80s. I forget, it may have been called Headbangers Ball Daily or something. It was only like a half-hour show, but it was always on at a time where my buddy and I were not quite home from school yet. So he would set his VCR to record that every day. Uh-huh. And we would walk home from school, go to his house, and watch that on video. And when they premiered the Wasted Years video, we were gobsmacked. It was just the quick flashes of all these different images from throughout Maiden's career up to this point. Yeah. And we sat there with the pause button just because there's so many things, yes, these quick flashes of things that you don't pick up on in real time.
Yeah.
You stop it, you pause it, and you're like, oh my God, there's that. That just added to my love of this song, was the way that they put that video together.
Yes.
With all the different, you know, again, Derek Riggs' artwork is much of what's happening in that video. And what he's done for them over the years. Because not only did he do the album covers, but when they released singles, mm-hmm, he did all the artwork for the singles too. So we would pick up the singles just for the artwork.
Yes, yeah. It's
and the B-sides. They had a lot of good B-sides too.
Yeah, I think this is why they're such an enduring band and the fans are so passionate, is because they give you the whole package. It's not just like... some bands, and I'm not, this is not criticism, but some bands are like, here's our music, enjoy our music, and we'll be back later with some more music. Whereas Iron Maiden, it's almost like it's not quite a lifestyle, but they give you so much more than just the music to enjoy. Yeah, it's more than just like, here's some songs, and we'll see in 3 years with the next album. You know, it's like you got all this detail, and again with the subject matter, as we've mentioned before, to songs. There's so much more to dig into that can spark you off down, you know, reading books about history, reading books about culture and all this other stuff, you know. So, okay, well, before we wrap up today, we mentioned that this is the first time there's been a 2-year gap between the albums. That's partly because after Powerslave came out, they went on the World Slavery Tour, which at the time was one of the longest tours known to man, where they covered the whole globe, and that was documented on the first and probably the only essential live album of theirs, which is Live After Death, and it documented that World Slavery Tour, and this is one of the seminal live albums. It's up there with like the likes of Live at Leeds and, you know, the sort of definitive live albums that you can say actually, this is one you can't tell the history of this band without this album. You know, the later live albums are nice, but they're not as important as this one, because this one, again,
this is definitive, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to look at the first. I mean, you get the intro of Churchill's speech, and then you get Aces High into 2 minutes, into The Trooper, into Revelations. I'm guessing at the point that you heard those four songs, Mike, you're probably like, have I died and gone to heaven?
I was like, why can't I see this show live and in person?
I mean, that opening the show like that, I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, where do you go, really? I mean, it's, you know, for a lot of bands, that would be the closing three songs or four songs, you know? Yeah, their opening with that, you know? And, part also of the partly what makes this an iconic one is the Scream for Me, Long Beach.
I was just going to say that,
which I know he does it everywhere now, but it was on record, and it's like, the Scream for Me, Long Beach, is in his voice is so good.
I didn't even know where Long Beach was when I first heard this album, but I was like, yes, Scream for Me, Long Beach, wherever you are.
Yeah, and you know the video of this as well is available now, and you can see that, you know, it really marks a sort of the end of a chapter of, like, okay, this band is established now. They're a big, you know, they're one of the biggest metal bands in the world. You know, they're not, you know, they're edging towards superstardom, and you know, they are superstars in one way, but in terms of on a global sort of stage. And I thought you've probably watched this as well, Mike, the History of Iron Maiden documentaries that they put out as bonus editions on some of the DVDs, which are now available on YouTube. And their manager, Rod Smallwood, who often makes me think of... Spinal Tap is a whole conversation we can have in relation to Iron Maiden, because there are you could say there are definitely they play into some of those tropes at times. But I remember him talking about when looking at the footage of these shows for the Live After Death album. It's like, yeah, he was showcasing his band. I go, yeah, look where my boys are at. This is what they've achieved. You know, they're serious guys. You know, they played at Rock in Rio, which at the time was the biggest concert that ever staged. You know, went along with Queen. And yeah, they were just riding the crest of a wave of creative excellence, and it's going to continue tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, this one, it's definitely closing the book on this chapter of Maiden.
Yes.
Because as we start to go forward, they start to get a little bit more experimental and
Things change after this, definitely.
Yeah, there's a few changes that are happening after this. And it's probably because of that extensive tour that they did after the Power Slave album, that World Slavery tour, because that was what, 2 hours or 2 years?
Pretty much. That tour? Yeah, I know that.
Just every corner of the planet.
Yeah, and I think they insisted, I'm sure I remember something about either Harris or Dickens or all of them, like, we have to have some time off before we record the next album, because they've been knocking out, you know, not only knocking out albums an album a year, they've been knocking out classic albums every year and touring at the same time, and then done this humongous world tour, you know, playing everywhere, which is something they've continued to this day, playing the sort of places that maybe a lot of bands don't go. The album, say, Someone in Time, which we've talked about today, which followed, you know, Live After Death, you know, it does mark that change sonically. It's a bit different, and yeah, that change will continue as we head onwards into their catalogue. Okay, Mike. Anything else you want to add for today, or shall we'll wrap it up and we'll reconvene tomorrow?
Yeah, let's come back to this.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks for staying with us again today. I hope you've enjoyed our talk about day two of Iron Maiden Week. Again, if you want to contact the show on the social media, it's at Suburbs Pod. You can email the show rock@suburbspod.com. You can call the Suburban Party line on 612-440-1984. And you can contact me directly on Twitter. I'm at Powderfinger71, or Stephen Rowledge on Facebook. And Mike, you are?
I am at Mike Coley on Twitter, and also straight Mike Coley on Facebook. Also, 315music.com. You can see some of the stuff that I do when I'm not listening to Iron Maiden.
I mean, there is a time when you're not listening to Iron Maiden, Mike?
Well, yeah. Once in a while.
Okay, we'll see you tomorrow, folks.
Take care, guys. Excellent.